Welcome to the 7th edition of the St. Petersburg, Florida Area News Podcast for the year 2019. I'm your host, Joshua Black, and this episode will cover the three committee meetings held on February 14th. Happy Valentine's Day. The first committee to meet was the Budget, Finance, and Taxation Committee, also known as BF&T. The first presentation was in regard to the planned rate restructuring for stormwater collection. The city has decided to charge ratepayers based on the square footage of impervious area on their property. This change is scheduled to take place October 1st if all goes according to plan. There are four tiers based on the square footage of impervious area, not lot size, not percentage of impervious area to pervious area, etc. The consultant explained that in hard rain events, the stormwater that will enter the city's collection system will not be affected by the pervious area because most of that water will simply run off. No explanation was given, however, about the fact that most storms simply aren't that hard. In fact, the consultant himself called it a 100-year storm. Basically, he recommends that the city penalize ratepayers for what might happen during a 100-year storm, but not what the city does collect. In fact, the city is deliberately moving away from meter collection measurements. But if the city accepts all of his recommendations, property owners will be able to work with the city to reduce their rates. This is where the tyranny comes in. First, though, the city portal will show you what your new liability will be based on the city's assessment of your property's impervious surface area. Then you can appeal their findings, so as long as you do the expensive work of showing via professional service how their assessment is in error. Then, whether you agree with the city's assessment or not, there are credits proposed so that if you install certain green infrastructures like rain barrels, rain gardens, or anything else designed by man to clear suspended solids from stormwater, the city will then lower your rates based on the percentage of stormwater they expect to be cleared by your property. Basically, it's a reward for water they don't have to treat. In addition, you could make it so that your property actually retains all the water that falls on it. For that, you would get a stormwater management credit based on how much the property would be expected to hold during that mythical 100-year storm. And if you live on the water and you install some things to make sure that the runoff is cleared before entering the Tampa Bay or other bodies of water, you could qualify for the tidal water discharge credit. Now, the consultant noted these options are all very expensive. Anyone who did any of these things that have been recommended would be spending thousands of dollars on their landscape and property. And maybe that's the real motivation behind it. Did these folks have investments in the companies that manufacture these things? In any case, it's put these credits out of reach of any otherwise poor person who happens to own a lot with largely impervious surface area. Thus, only the rich would really benefit from the credits, and they might not even consider it worth the hassle. The proposed credits aren't all that great. Council members expressed concerns that citizens won't get enough notice. Foster noted that best marketing practices include 12 touches before expecting the target audience to begin to pay attention. City marketing plan only schedules 5 public meetings and a couple of mailings. Staff didn't seem too concerned about backlash, likely because the people who live here will be powerless to do anything about the changes once they happen. The proposal won't become official until September, but it seems likely to pass. Elections are coming up, but Montaneri seems opposed to the measure and likely won't field an opponent anyway, and Cornell and Gertis are in their last year on council regardless because of term limits. That leaves only Wheeler Bowman up for re-election, and even if she votes against it, you have 6 council members guaranteed to support it. The aforementioned Cornell and Gertis, you also have Rice, Driscoll, Gabbard, and Foster. I suppose the voter outrage can move those scales, but staff is fully ready to implement this plan, so either get loud or brace yourselves. Next presentation involved an effort to get utilities buried underground along the Pinellas Bayway. Pinellas County has been doing that for the beach communities, and the Alliance of Bayway Communities is trying to get Duke Energy and Spectrum to agree to allow a contractor to do the same for them. The leader of that group asked for $25,000 from the city to get a cost estimate from the 2 engineering contractors in the county that are capable of handling the work. Gertis expressed hesitation, not because he doesn't agree with the cause, but because he expects Duke to resist the overture. Foster made a motion to request from the Alliance a memo regarding the results of their Monday meeting with Duke and to continue the request until then. The entire committee agreed. Next committee was the Public Services and Infrastructure Committee, also known as PS&I. Liz Abernathy from Planning and Michael Dima from the legal team took turns answering questions about the idea to expand the kinds of Development Review Commission decisions that could be appealed to council before going to circuit court. Staff insisted that the new workload would be too great and that the outcomes wouldn't change significantly. In fact, Dima seemed to suggest that things said by council members during these quasi-judicial hearings were being used against the city during court proceedings. In the end, the idea to make changes was defeated to the relief of staff and administration, and the change that Steve Cornell wanted to see the most wasn't even put into the motion. He wanted to remove the rule that overturning DRC decisions requires a supermajority vote of the council, but being chair, he couldn't make that motion. Based on the vote, I'm not sure it would have passed. The next item on their agenda was to consider a new ordinance for sidewalk tables. In high pedestrian traffic areas downtown, some folks are putting up tables in areas that others have already paid for a permit to have a sidewalk cafe or hot dog stand, and these folks aren't happy about it. But the cops can't arrest the folks or tell them to leave because the law doesn't prohibit them explicitly. This area would be limited in area of enforcement to the area bounded by 2nd Avenue South for the south, 4th Street to the west, 5th Avenue North to the north, and Beach Drive to the east until south of 1st Avenue South, and then 1st Street would be the boundary. Councilmember Driscoll said that public safety is the real reason for the proposal, stating that tables, by their nature, can impede safe flow of foot traffic in the event of an emergency, trusting that permitted tables for sidewalk cafes and the like are not the same sort of impediment because of the regulations they are said to comply with. However, the city attorney who helped craft the piece said that the city was mindful of the idea that folks with information tables might feel targeted, and that the city had taken steps to abide by previous court rulings so as not to run afoul of those concerns. The committee forwarded the full measure to City Council, and the first reading is for February 21st. For the Health, Energy, Resiliency, and Sustainability Committee, it was time to meet the new fleet management director, Randall Johnston. He spoke of his desire to move to a more green and cost-efficient fleet. Now, to his perspective, cost-efficient means buying higher-priced vehicles if the maintenance costs and downtime are reduced enough to justify it. No telling if we, the taxpayers, will agree with his assessments of his purchases. The challenge with making these cost efficiencies a reality is the fact that to implement green fleets, new infrastructures are necessary for the city to be able to use and service the new technologies. One of the reasons that electric vehicles have been so limited throughout the country is that electric charging stations are not cheap and are not plentiful. Cities also considering biosolids and compressed natural gas. During the course of discussion, Councilmember Rice spoke about the pollution caused not only by the operation, but also by the manufacturing and maintenance of standard fossil fuel burning vehicles. But she ignores the same pollution concerns for the manufacturing of electric vehicles and the electricity required to run them. All the complaints about coal and nuclear power plants seem to ignore the fact that the cost of electricity would keep electric cars in the dream world without those polluting and high-risk operations in place. Fortunately, God made the earth with trees to draw in the carbon dioxide we create by using fossil fuels and by manufacturing the cars that use them and that use electricity. As part of his green assessment, Johnston wants to get computerized measurements of the workload and pollution output for each vehicle via telematics, which includes GPS tracking, among other things. Gurdes noted that some employees will be alarmed by the idea that their employer is tracking what they do with the vehicles they use for work. He floated the idea of giving a financial incentive for cooperation. I'm not sure that would assuage their concerns, and I'm not sure that piling another cost on top of new equipment for implementing these measurements is a good idea. For those who want to raise concerns about waste, I would point out that every city function that is already provided in the marketplace is itself a waste of tax dollars. Trash collection, recycling collection, sewage treatment, event security, and many other services are already provided by private corporations and small businesses in this county to residents of other areas, some municipal and some unincorporated. The city could abandon all of those functions without loss of service to the residents, and the need for such a large fleet would then vanish. In addition, as long as there are no monopolies granted in these areas of service, whether by declaration or by regulation, the cost to the city residents would actually fall because the inefficiencies of government bureaucracies would be eliminated. After his presentation, Sustainability Director Sharon Wright gave an update on the Integrated Sustainability Action Plan called ISAP. Basically, the city wants to control growth, development, and everyday activities of residents by assessing whether what people are trying to do with their lives or businesses is sustainable, in the city's opinion. There are a lot of lofty statements of ideas and strategy, but it boils down to us paying the city to decide what we can and can't do in the places we pay rent, mortgages, and taxes. No specifics were given on the summary, but the action plan should be available for review on the city's website soon. Also, the search for a climate advisor has been narrowed, and that job will be filled soon as well. Now, the afternoon meeting consisted of awards and presentations and city council committee meeting reports. We've previously reported on each of those committees. However, one thing I learned from last week is that when council committee reports are read, the community members can use that time to raise concerns about the presentations that the committees have heard. You just get a yellow card from the clerk and write in your information, as well as the agenda item number that goes with the committee report you wish to speak about. You can actually do this for almost any item on the agenda. You get 3 minutes to speak your mind, and the council members have to listen. After all, you're paying for it. Speaking of listening, thank you for listening. This has been St. Petersburg, Florida Area News, a production of the Reconstructionist Radio Network.